You're ready. You're on.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. We're meeting for a informal discussion today about Enterprise Products Partners LP. The way it lays out is this is more than likely going to be a case that comes in front of the commission. So we made sure we noticed it and did all the things we're supposed to do. But I really, speaking for myself, really appreciate you coming in today and kind of giving us a background on the company, whatever else you think appropriate. And so, really, I guess that's probably it from my viewpoint. I'll be happy to see if Commissioner Christman has any comments.
Only to say that obviously any specific projects have to be looked at individually, but I reflect back. Oftentimes, Brian and Julie get tired of hearing me talk about this, but I reflect back to the 90s in the legislature when there was nothing going on, and almost no matter what career path a young person would choose, there was very little opportunity in North Dakota. Now we have a lot of opportunities, but I never get tired of hearing about people who are looking to create additional opportunities and to invest in North Dakota and all the things that we produce here. So it's nice to meet you, and we're anxious to hear about your ideas.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchak, any opening comments?
I don't have any. I'm excited to hear about it, and okay. Thanks for taking time to meet with us.
Commissioner Kalk?
Yeah, I know Sandy and Niles. I just figured, who'd I turn it over to? Sandy, if you could
just
introduce.
Just for a second.
All right.
To first thank you all for letting us come in and just introduce Jim to the team. He's with Enterprise Products, and he's going to go through the handout with you. But we appreciate that this will be a separate case, but we really thought it would be important for you to understand a little more detail about the company itself and then actually just give you a very high-level overview of where we think the project's going and what it all will entail, because it's a pretty impressive project, and we think you're going to be pretty excited about it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
Thank you, Sandy. As I introduce myself before, I'm Jim Cesarek. I'm Senior Vice President of Government Affairs and Public Relations for Enterprise. Thank you for taking the time to meet with us. We're very excited about the opportunity to introduce the project to you, and we've hired KLJ to help us in this region. We're new to the region with regards to infrastructure. We are purchasing crude in the area, and we have relationships with many of the producers who are developing this basin from other basins across the country. So we're excited to introduce the opportunity to you. What I felt would be appropriate if I would first tell you a little bit about our company. We are, if not the largest midstream energy partnership, we're one of the largest. Our enterprise value is approaching $90 billion, and so I only say that to show you that we're very capable of a project this size. I'm going to talk to you today about a 1,200-mile, 30-inch crude oil pipeline project that originates in the Bakken and goes to catch the Powder River Basin, then the DJ Basin in Colorado, through the Mississippian area once we get closer to Cushing, Oklahoma, and then the project would terminate at Cushing. At that point, we have about 850,000 barrels a day of takeaway capability from Cushing with our Seaway pipeline. We're in all the hydrocarbon products. We're in not only crude oil, but natural gas liquids, but also refined products as well as petrochemicals. So our goal and culture is to touch as many of these products that are produced out of these basins or derived from these basins as possible, so we can be a customer service provider to these producers and create a very liquid market for them. Just at the bottom of slide 3, I wanted to give you a little more when we talk about what we're building and how much we're spending. During the last 5.5 years, we've spent about $21 billion building infrastructure in the United States. That's not only pipelines, but processing plants, fractionators, and various midstream infrastructure. We're probably averaging a run rate of about $4 billion a year. So with that, again, we're very capable building a project of this size. As I mentioned to the KLJ group and Senator Hoeven and the governor just this morning, We recently have built pipelines of 42-inch diameter in North and South Louisiana. 36-inch are very commonplace for us, so a 30-inch pipeline is basically something that we feel very comfortable with. If you go to slide 4, this is our asset base. We've got over 50,000 miles of pipelines in the United States. We have a tremendous amount of storage, most in liquids. We have 200 million barrels of storage, most of which is on the Gulf Coast. Just $100 million is specific to our Mount Bellevue complex, southeast of Houston. Processing plants, we have 24 of those and almost that many fractionators. And the fractionators are the facilities that take the Y-grade and process them into purity products like ethane, propane, butanes, and gasoline. We've also created opportunities on the export side. You know, we follow the producibility of the basins. We have geologists and petroleum engineers that research and keep tabs on over 60 basins in the United States. So we want to have an idea not only of the producibility and the longevity of these basins, but also what kind of volumes of products they produce, not only crude oil and natural gas, but also the natural gas liquids that can be produced from these natural gas streams. And with that, we try to stay very far in front of the supply-demand balance in the United States. So with that, we've recently announced an ethane export dock that could be capable of almost 240,000 barrels a day of ethane, being that in the hydrocarbon molecule, we feel the ethane is the most at risk because when you produce an NGL barrel, most often that's 50% of the barrel. So we're working with producers as well as the consumers and end users on that. We also, to give an example, we turned around a pipeline that was a refined products pipeline from the Gulf Coast of the Marcellus Utica this past January, put it in service where now we're exporting ethane out of the Marcellus Utica region, bringing it to the Gulf Coast where the petrochemical ethylene crackers can use that feedstock. And hence where before they were struggling up in the region to get that ethane out, now we've created a route to get the ethane out where there's market demand, and now the producers have really their back where they've thrown a lot of rigs at the region again, knowing that they can get rid of the ethane out of that region.
So just on a knowledge-gaining opportunity, mm-hmm. There's no export approval for ethane like from the FERC or somebody?
I'm sorry,
like
Commissioner?
The FERC has to approve certain maybe it's presidential.
No, because it is a product like propane and butanes. It's already been a product that is more toward a refined product.
No, that's
where you
good.
Can
I
always,
just didn't know
which
that.
Is good.
And then
yeah.
The gas opportunity in the state, is that something you're looking at to become a competitor to a One Oak? Or
we do, and what we are very careful of, as you can see by our asset base, everything we do has connectivity. So with this project, we'll be in the Bakken with this project, and that'll create more upstream opportunities. Our biggest business in our company is on a natural gas liquid basis. We're big processors. We're big fractionators. We're big rich gas gatherers. So, and we're probably the biggest NGL company in the United States. So this link into the basin will facilitate more opportunities in the basin for us. But we're normally very careful about entering into a basin unless we have a real good plan. So hopefully this will give us an entree into the basin. As I mentioned before, we have relationships with the majority of the producers up here in other basins. So, that should help us with an entree into doing some other things. Yes, sir.
I have a question, too.
Yes.
This is in the knowledge gathering arena as well. We could probably have you here for a couple hours, but we won't. Are you on that ethane project you talked about? Did you say you're fractionating ethane and then just shipping that? You're just
really what's happening in that particular case is there are fractionators up in the Marcellus and Utica, and we're taking the ethane off the fractionators and moving it down to the Gulf Coast. In the Gulf Coast area, we're finishing up an ethane on-demand header for all the petrochemical companies. It'll run from Corpus all the way to the west part of New Orleans. And so all those petrochemicals, the ethylene crackers that are either expanding or some of the new crackers will be able to consume that ethane. So we're bringing that product down to an area where there's a use for it. In the region, the Marcellus Utica, there's not really a use for it. So things like that that we're able to do when you have that continuity of infrastructure where you can create some opportunities to create that disposition. So that's exactly what we're doing up there. Yes, Commissioner.
Now, I'd heard that that wasn't financially feasible to do in North Dakota, to just ship the ethane. Is it because we don't have as much of a supply of it here?
What you may end up doing there is just processing the gas and moving the whole Y-grade mm-hmm. stream somewhere down to fractionation where there's more distribution. But that's something where I know our guys are already looking at. They're looking at the region. We're analyzing the region right now for more opportunities for us to help. Okay. If you go to slide 5 real quickly, this is what our crude oil asset look like right now. You can see we're in the Permian. We're big into the Eagle Ford and the Houston area, but our main pipeline down from Oklahoma is really two lines. We've got our Seaway line from Cushing to the Houston area, and we've just put in service a loop of that line. So together they can carry 850,000 barrels a day from the Cushing area down to the Gulf Coast. But what's been interesting about all this, all the barrels for the last couple of years have been seeking a Gulf Coast market, and it's left a big void in Cushing. So not one thing nice about this project is that our producers who we're talking to, they like is that getting to Cushing again will provide them an opportunity to create distribution for the Cushing market. But if they had to, they can use our Seaway vehicle to get down to the Gulf Coast if needed. So it gives them a couple options. If you go to slide 7, this is just kind of a graphical presentation of what we as an enterprise company, we follow the basins. We have geologists and engineers that look at all these basins. But you can see, you know, the Bakken Three Forks, they think it can get as high as 1.6 million barrels a day. You know, there's people here in the state I know with technology, they probably hopefully think we can get it to over 2 million barrels or more. So that's hopeful. And we have confidence there. The DJ
Basin. What does Texas produce? I just had a reference. What is Texas barrels a day?
Well, right now, I think the Permian, we're over about 1.6 today. Eagle Ford, we look at the Eagle Ford as both crude and condensate. I think in the aggregate, we're probably 1.2 or 1.3. The Permian right now, we out of all the horizontal rigs in this country, I think the third of those rigs are in the Permian.
We still can't catch Texas.
Well, we welcome you to try. It doesn't matter where the barrels come from. But what's interesting, I was mentioning to the governor this morning what we're starting to see in the Permian, because there's so many rigs there, the production is outpacing the infrastructure export areas, just the disposition to get it out of the basin. And we're actually seeing about a $20 to $22 depression in the price in the Permian compared to Cushing right now, because I think the refiners see it's being overproduced. They're struggling to get it out of there. So that's why the pace of getting these pipelines installed is so important, so you can keep that the disposition of the product moving instead of getting it stacked up in the basin. So we're starting to see some difficulties in pricing out there. And we have a couple projects coming out of the Permian, not only us but others, to try to help. But a lot of these projects are minimum 2 years to get installed. So,
okay. Do you see the potential to export the raw crude changing these dynamics that you're talking about?
Well, what's interesting, we have a lot of friends in Congress that are trying to push crude exports. Senator Murkowski and others are working toward that. The Eagle Ford's really interesting. About 40% of what we're seeing in the Eagle Ford is condensate. And so we saw that very early on, and we started studying the BIS rules. If you have read some of the announcements, it's us and Pioneer Resources who have gone to the BIS and gotten clarification that with some heavy processing and distillation, we can actually look at condensate as a refined product, and so we've actually exported. We did our first ship about 2 weeks ago of condensate. So we're set up on the Gulf Coast with marine facilities to export condensate, refined products, propane, whatever. And we actually did our first ship a few weeks ago. So we're already set up to do that. So any of the, if there's condensate in the Bakken, and usually we look at condensate as being kind of 48 gravity and higher, and if we can distill it enough to make it a refined product as per those rules, then we've got the infrastructure to bring it down to the Gulf Coast to potentially export it for those producers. So
we don't have condensate, though, do we?
We have small portions of condensate.
Do we?
Maybe some condensate windows.
We shove it back in with the crude. It's the only way we can dispose of it. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a condensate market per se, but it is a product that we turn out. Mm-hmm. And then condensate is also one of those products that we're shipping into Manitoba to dilute down those heavy crudes so that they can make them shippable. So there's a condensate market, but it ends up being the same. It ends up being blended back into the Canadian crudes and allowing them to ship those. And that's out of that Tioga plant where they do that capture and ship back up north.
Is that piped up there then?
Yep. Okay. There's an, I believe it's an Enbridge line that they reversed to ship condensate up. Kind of parallels that CO2 line that went in 4 or 5 years ago from the other gasification plant. Those are in very close to the same corridor, in the same field for sure.
Thank you, Niles. If you go to slide 9, this is just kind of a stair-step graph showing all the pipeline capacity that's been built from Cushing and the Permian, Eagleford, to take that volume all the way down to the Gulf Coast, and that's really created a void in Cushing. Cushing by itself has 80 million barrels of storage. It has 14 different operators, a significant distribution system. So that's what's really creating for our producers that we're talking to the desire to get down to Cushing. That's their first option, as I mentioned before. Then we can always take them further down to the south if needed. If you go to slide 11, I'm going to go through the project overview in the next couple slides. I want to qualify the route. A few weeks ago, we were looking at a route that would go into Montana. The DLJ people are helping us now. We're actually looking at some different routes that would actually keep us in North Dakota all the way to South Dakota. So I want to qualify what you're looking at here. But the main objective, of course, is to provide a route that would catch the main points in the Williston Basin at Stanley in a place called Johnson's Corner, and then route it through the Powder River Basin. We have producers there that would welcome us there, get through the DJ Basin, and on the way to Cushing, catch the Mississippian Basin. We are designing this project similar to what we're doing in the Eagleford, because in the Eagleford we have various grades of crude as well. We're going to transport 5 different grades of crude oil. There's going to be some intermediate grades, the Bakken. We're going to be able to make sure we can transport condensate batches as well. So we're going to set up the pipeline as a batch system so we can move at least 5 different crude and condensate streams. Make sure we can accommodate all the producers depending on the regions or the different positions they have in the different basins. If you go to slide...
Quick curiosity question. How quickly do you turn around like a pipeline where you'd one day be shipping condensate and then...
Well, you schedule batches, and so you have to have enough tankage to do that. So you'll introduce the different grades into the tanks, and then you'll introduce a certain batch stream into the pipeline, and then you'll schedule the next batch, and you'll always have an interface type of stream. You know, you may have an intermediate grade and a condensate batch, and so you'll have that interface that you'll have to dispose of, and that'll create its own different batch. But we're doing it in the Eagleford. I'm not sure... Commissioner what the turnaround time is. We'll be ready to answer that for you. I'll have some engineers, but that's a good question. But they do it regularly like that. But so you do that for a while, and then you introduce the next grade, and you'll keep it moving. But you have to have a lot of infrastructure, large diameter pipes, and good tankage to do that. Like I mentioned before, we have it's a 1,200-mile project, 30-inch. Initially, it'll be capable of transporting 340,000 barrels a day. But hydraulically, what we're doing is we're setting up, like we do all of our large diameter pipes, the capability to install some additional intermediate horsepower so we can take it up to 700,000 barrels a day. So the majority of the crude oil will probably come from the Bakken area, so we've got to make sure hydraulically that as the basin grows, we can try to introduce as much of that volume as possible into the pipeline. We'll have a spur coming from Johnson Corner into the about 60-mile spur, and that's as we're designing it today. That could change with the routing of the pipeline as well.
We've never had a pipeline company come to us and say, we built it too big. Mm-hmm. They start with 6-inch, and then it's 10-inch, and the hearing it's 14 inches. Mm-hmm. I mean, 30 inches, I mean, why not 36?
Well, ironically, we have 36-inch probably at the back of our mind. Every time we built a large diameter pipe, and this happened in the Haynesville, we started out with a 36-inch, and we ended up building a 42-inch. So what we always do is
that's a lot of money difference, I guess.
Well, but what's good is if you're going to get the barrels to move and you have a bigger diameter pipe, it's a lot more efficient and a lot more economical to have a bigger pipe than to start adding pump stations because you lose efficiency. And that's what, you know, they're all going to help us with. And we have hydraulic folks at our company that are designing it in a way that we can easily move from a 30-inch to a 36-inch if needed, and then we have the horsepower designed appropriately for that. So we're going to be making some decisions in the near future, but we're starting out no smaller diameter than a 30-inch, but that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
I kind of peeked ahead a little bit, and I didn't see it, but you may be covering it. Do you have when you think the application might be filed?
I'm not sure, Niles. When do you...
My guess, to me, 2016 completion, if we can make that happen, the application will have to be filed by February. So, and we're working, the issue that needs to be resolved first is what the federal nexus will be.
Yep.
What the feds will decide as to regards to how they will take jurisdiction, because it's 1,200 miles and crosses through 5 states, and then what actions they will require, whether they will require an EIS, or yep. Whether they will allow each state to do their major siting, mm-hmm. and then simply do EAs at the crossing. So there is a very limited amount of federal impact around the route. We're hoping that they will allow for an EA, and if an EA goes forth, then we would be introducing the application as early as February.
I think this is good to learn about us, to learn about you, but to all of you to get some candid feedback from us of the things that we're normally looking for. And
definitely.
You know,
definitely.
My experience has been whether it's a power line or a pipeline, where they cross into state borders and getting those anchor points early, it's been a big issue. Mm-hmm. We had a power line project that completely got all way behind schedule because one state approved A and another state approved B, and, of course, they don't match. You got problems.
Exactly.
And so we just went through the siting of the Enbridge line, and so anything that the criteria that I think we looked at for Enbridge, I think you'd see a lot of the same questions about in the water bodies and things, the spill response and the depth and all those engineering concerns. So that part, I think KLJ knows what we normally ask for that stuff. But
right.
I do think that that federal nexus piece, it is it's not a requirement for us to have a decision, for me, to have a decision on what the EA says. We oftentimes do contingent orders. We just went through a big power line where we said contingent upon a final, no significant impact, we agree with it, but we made our decision and left it kind of out there, so then we weren't the ones holding up the project. And so I just throw that out there, that once you get to what we might need here to make a decision, that the earlier we get it in front of us, the earlier we can schedule hearings and do all those things that we're supposed to do, if you wait to get the final approval from all these other bodies and then come in front of us, I think you take 6 months to delay that you don't have to put in there.
Okay.
That's just speaking for myself, but I think that's kind of a very pragmatic way to approach it.
Well, thank you for that guidance. Thank mm-hmm. you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, some of the other things, speaking of the timeline, some of the strategies that we're going to employ, we've got this 1,200 miles. We're going to have 17 spreads. So you can have, you know, basically 17 contracting companies, and each of these spreads will be about 75 to 80 miles long and probably employ between 600 and 800 people. So that way we can finish a little quicker than if you just had four or five different companies on these spreads. Additionally, what we're looking at doing, a project of this size would normally take a single mill about 600 days to mill the pipe and roll it. And we're probably going to be dividing this project in the and we're going to be giving it to three domestic mills. So we'll split up those the single and the three and probably have 200 days of rolling. So that'll save us 400 days of rolling by dividing that up. So we've had other large projects like that. We have relationships with the mills and the, a lot of the contractors and the pipe layers. And so we're kind of used to seeing what works well. And so the more division of labor here, the better for us. And it's really the producers that are asking us to expedite all this. They're, you know, they want to develop the basin, and they have aspirations, and they have the sights of 4Q 2016 in mind, really asking us to help them as best as they can. So that's what all of them, and we appreciate your guidance in helping us as well. So we're going to rely on all of you to help us on that. So
In my experience, whether it's once again a pipeline or a power line, the delays have not been from the commission making a decision. The delays have been the SHPO final concurrence or the Fish and Wildlife thing. Or we've approved projects. The Bakken Link comes to mind, where the Corps of Engineers still hasn't made a decision on going underneath the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think those other bodies are going to be the ones that to spend the time with, because
mm-hmm.
we can make our orders contingent upon things.
Okay. Thank you. The next few slides, especially slide 13, that just shows you, this is a page of a presentation we've been providing to all of our producers, but you can see the different grades of crude oil that we're going to be shipping, and the tariffs. You can see the difference in what we believe are very competitive tariffs compared to other distribution routes coming out of the basin. And then slide 14 is just showing the flow assurance. Everything's going to be brand new pipe, brand new tanks. We have a 24/7 control center in Houston that we monitor all the inlets and outlets and the pressures of all of our pipelines and plants. So it'll be 24/7 monitored. We have a lot of flexibility.
How do you monitor that, something that big? Because that'll be one of the questions. There'll come a lot of details. But can you monitor down to real-time flow between
sure.
a mile? Or
sure.
how often do you check your flow points?
What we do is we have a 24/7 control center, and we have shifts, and we have certain individuals of teams that will monitor a certain pipeline or area, and they'll become very familiar with that area. We'll have alarm points set on certain crucial controls that monitor pressure, and so they can see real-time pressure all the time on all the inlets, the outlets, some of the mainline valves. So we're constantly monitoring the whole project. So if you have an upset in pressure, for example, you know, if you have just third-party damage, you have a backhoe strike a pipeline, we can immediately see the segment losing pressure, so we know there's been some type of event. We dispatch our operations people immediately out there. We have relationships with that we create with all the emergency response teams and all the different areas, so we have strategies.
We always ask those questions about, have you talked to the county emergency manager? What capabilities on site, and the time delay from the guy or gal in Houston doing something till the emergency manager comes out locally.
Sure, and we'll be ready to respond to that in very, very detail, you bet.
Thank you. You have your own people monitoring as opposed to contracting with someone else?
Normally, yes. And we have contractors doing mechanical reliability work on our compressors sometime, but normally we'll have our own employees along the pipeline. So we've already talked to our HR people, human resource people, and they're already trying to determine some strategies on potential hiring of people in this region, so they're already working on that.
And so a pipeline of this kind of length that traverses pretty much the whole country, is that its own entity for flow control, or is that just
for part of your set
of pipelines all over the country?
Then? Well, until we get more infrastructure, a pipeline of this magnitude, we'll probably have our own desk. We'll have set up a desk for this everything Cushing to the north, and it'll be we have certain desks that cover certain assets, and usually we put them into regions, geographical regions. But something like this, I imagine having its own region and its own desk to monitor 24/7. But those are answers, obviously, to questions that we'll be ready to respond to you with once we get the strategies deployed. So.
Stepping back a little bit more, bigger picture, what kind of a effort are you making to follow existing corridors?
That's pretty paramount with us. Anywhere we can, we always go follow transmission lines, pipelines, whatever, and that's what the DLJ folks are helping us with right now. Sometimes you can't because there's nothing there. One of the critical pieces, of course, will be power for these pumping stations, so the DLJ folks, KLJ, sorry, I apologize, are helping us identifying power needs. So,
okay.
But that's really all I had for my presentation. I welcome any questions that you have. So.
Well, I think I asked all the questions two-bit I had worked well. Randy?
I don't really have questions. I think, you know, and it's probably pretty obvious that, you know, one of your key issues, I think, in getting from Stanley to the south is, you know, you're going to probably have to traverse a reservation, a federal park, and a lake. And so you've got some of the best folks in the state working with you, and I commend you for choosing them. But so I'm sure if it wasn't obvious when you first looked at the map, they've probably told you that already.
And that's what we do. We when we go into a region like this, we want to get the experts, and we knew the KLJ people have a lot of experience. And as you can tell, we've got 50,000 miles of pipelines. We have a lot of plants. We have a tremendous amount of plant site in Mount Bellevue, east of Houston, so that's even more of an urban area. Even though it's a plant site, you're close to Houston, so you know our company is very used to being very sensitive to the community and making sure we never cut corners and do the right thing with regards to any mediation and anything we need to do within the community to make sure we're a good neighbor and because we're going to live with these landowners hopefully for 70, 80, 90, 100 years once we traverse them. So what we normally do is make sure we visit with people like you, all the agencies, governor's office, legislators, introduce the project. But even before we talk to the landowner, we'll make sure we meet with any county commissioners or anyone like that to introduce the project. So anyone that a landowner may call to go, hey, who are these people? What are they doing? To make sure the people that they can call have an understanding of what we're trying to achieve and make sure we publicize it enough like that. So, and then we always do appraisals and get with KLJ help, really understand what the market is. So we go in there and we're well received with these landowners with whom we would negotiate servitude. So,
well, I would just say, you know, although I heard the presentation over at the summit at BSC, but I do appreciate you reaching out this way.
Thank you.
You know, I think we all try and make sure we're doing our jobs and the things are done appropriately, but not trying to do it in an adversarial way. And it's a lot easier to do those, to accomplish those kinds of goals when you've met the people and know who you're dealing with. And so I appreciate you coming up here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Commissioners, we began operating the BOE pipeline about 4 or 5 weeks ago now. So I would invite you to come to our KLJ on our third floor where is the FERC control center, and we can show you how leak detection works, and we can show you what Jim was talking about. We can actually walk you through simulated situations, or we can show you where a pressure drop may occur, and then you can watch the responses that come forth with regards to how long it takes the sequence of supervisors to approve, and then how long dispatching takes. And then, just as importantly, you can see the science behind it. You can watch the algorithms, which is very difficult right now because when a pipeline starts up, it's its own creature. So you basically have to figure out what's a false negative coming in telling you you've got a problem and it's not a problem, and what's a real problem. And so that's the stages that we're in now. So it's kind of a robust state as the pipeline starts deciding how it likes pressure and how it's going to respond along the line. So anytime, we'd be glad to have you come in and just take you up, and the guys in the center can run you through how it works.
And you do that at your office here in town?
Yeah, we do that in in our office. Yeah, we run we run a number of them, but this is a crude pipeline, which is very sensitive and very unique. And the difference between an existing crude pipeline that may try to operate this way and a new pipeline is substantially changed, because we're able to design in different types of equipment, different types of sensor points, and then just the software itself is so much more robust. And so, again, once you get a pipeline system operating with its leak detection systems understood, you don't want to be changing softwares. So it's generally the generation of when you go online gives you the robustness of the response systems and the detection. So you'll be able, we can demonstrate that all for you at any point you'd like.
All right. I'll come up. One of my favorite things to do is to watch algorithms.
We'll show you those things and say, here's where it's at today.
That is now, so awesome.
It's like growing grass.
Anything else, Jules?
I had one other thing, but I forgot it, so it's not be.
Just throw this out. It'll be a decision the three of us will make when the time comes, but as a rule of thumb, you know, 200 miles ends up being three hearings. 150 miles, 100 miles ends up being two hearings. So somewhere in there, depending on the mileage, I wouldn't imagine more than three hearings, probably a couple. Mm-hmm. But that's just kind of just to get you a feel for. But the sooner the application comes to Julie Prescott right there and she gets a chance to go through it, the sooner we can get moving on things. And we found that we make our decisions that sometimes helps others make their decisions too. So going once, going twice.
Good.
All right. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.